The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, hello, it's Sunday morning. I'm not saying there's too much Price of Football in my life, but I opened the door on my advent calendar this morning, there's a picture of you. But they're probably what I should expect from a Moscow nightclub advent calendar. It took a lot.
That's true.
Took a lot of finding. I've only managed to find three doors so far as well. Some of those doors are very difficult. It's questions day, Kieran, and we've got some good questions and some lengthy questions. So I think we should probably eschew the usual banter at the start and get straight into it. And then you never know, BAFTA might still be listening right at the end when we're still being clever and grown up. But our first question, Kira, comes from Craig Hall, and I'm getting slightly worried. Blackburn Rovers, you know, you just get an instinct, a little feel that things start to build up, and you suddenly get more questions and news stories about a club. And at the moment, it's Blackburn Rovers. We're getting a lot of questions about Blackburn. And this one from Craig Hall is around the financing of EFL Championship clubs, specifically mine, says Craig, Blackburn Rovers. Our current debt to our owners, the Venkies, I believe stands at around £180 million, and we are currently under threat of embargo following the last financial period. My question is, in the EFL, can an owner underwrite the club's debts and effectively bankroll the club with no effect on financial fair play? So how does the finance situation work broadly with FFP, within the EFL? And again, it's another question that indicates, Kieran, that none of us, and I'm happy to admit that includes me, fully understand how FFP works within the different leagues and what the rules are. It strikes me that something does need to be streamlined or simplified, or we need to be, some kind of basic crib sheet needs to be sent to every football fan.
Yeah, if only we had a coordinated football body which had universal rules.
Speaking of which, we will be talking to somebody who's come up with that idea this week. Tracy Crouch will be on the pod this week. So if you have any questions for Tracy about the fan-led football report, then please let us know. But I'm really looking forward to that, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing her reaction to some of the criticism it's been getting.
Yes, Comrade Tracy, as she'll be known.
It's how bizarre. I wonder what the other Tory MPs think when Comrade Tracy walks into the Tory MP bar and does whatever Tory MP, God forbid, I don't even want to know what they're doing there. But it must be very strange for a Tory MP to be compared to Chairman Mao. But anyway, Craig Hall's question and the Venkies, Kieran.
Right. An owner can put as much money into a football club as they wish. And we've seen Roman Abramovich put in around about, I think it's about 1.4 billion into Chelsea. Yeah. At Brighton, we've got Tony Bloom, who's put in 400 million. Clearly, we've got Sheikh Mansour, who's put huge amounts into Manchester City. Stoke City's owners have put. So the actual physical cash that can be put into a club is limitless, as is the case for any business. If you've got a business investor, they can generate as much money from either individuals or institutions as they wish. But in terms of FFP, the way that it works in the EFL Championship is that over a rolling 3-year period, the first £90 million from the owners is counted towards FFP. So if you put in 90 million, all of it counts. If you put in 200 million, only the first 90 million counts. If you put in 20 million, it's that 20 million counts. So that's the way that it works. And on top of that, the clubs are allowed to lose a further 15 million themselves under the FFP rules. So it's 15 million from your day to day, but you can top that up by a further 90 million for FFP purposes. And then you can top that up as much as you so desire. From a perspective of the sustainability, allowing the club to continue. So in the case of Blackburn, I mean, Blackburn have lost £196 million in the last decade, and sort of contextualise that, that works out as around about, I think it's about 370 grand a week. And this is the Venkies who rarely turn up. Yeah, they don't come to watch the football. They might watch it on iFollow. I know some people that have been senior at Blackburn, and they say we don't know why they do it, but we love the fact that they do. So, you know, quite often there'll be a monthly meeting taking place on Zoom or its equivalent, and they say, well, we need so much money to allow us to pay the wages and the other costs of Blackburn Rovers this month, and somebody at the other end of the call, you know, at the Venkies end in India, will say, oh, okay, right, we'll wire across a check immediately. And that's great, provided they keep doing it. And yeah. The concerns are, and there's no evidence that this will be the case, you know, what happens if the owner turns out to be another Tony G, as we saw with Aston Villa, who ran out of money for reasons we're not quite sure. We had Stuart Day at Bury, which led to Steve Dale coming in, and then the destruction of Bury. And then we've got Mel Morris at Derby County, who was very generous for a while. Then he decided he was going to run the club effectively using the taxpayers' money. And then the club went into administration, and he's walked off into the sunset owning the ground. And reading some of the reports about Derby, we don't want to raise Derby unless we have to, but things are getting more twitchy there, because there are now talks about the club going out of business, which you hope isn't going to be the case. But those are the actual rules themselves.
This is a phrase I know some Blackburn fans won't like me saying, but to be fair to the Venkies, it's been quite some time now that they've been in charge of the club. And when you consider that they could quite easily have walked away at the start, I was there for one of the demonstrations against the Venky takeovers, and it was angry. It was properly angry. I mean, it was quite funny because they were releasing chickens on the pitch left, right and centre, but they've stopped giving the impression quite some time ago to me that they're in it for the short haul. As you say, they don't look like owners that are suddenly going to pull the plug. But there again, Mel Morris didn't until 2 weeks before, and there again, other clubs could say the same thing, I suppose.
Yeah, I think in the Venkies didn't do their homework. They didn't realise that there was relegation. They thought it was similar to the MLS or the IPL. So when they bought into Blackburn, they thought that they were guaranteed revenues going forwards. And certainly my understanding from if you listen to Blackburn podcasts or if you go onto their forums, is that there's now a sort of more of a grudging respect for what the Venkies have done, because the alternative would be that the club would be genuinely struggling. And although I think the anger of the fans towards the Venkies is directed towards the lack of on-field success that they've had, there's also an acknowledgement from the fan base that without them, the club would be in a genuinely precarious position, because it's a working class area. It's Blackburn as a town is reasonable size, but it's not huge. So therefore, it's got a sort of an automatic cap in terms of the expectation of attendances as a league, as an EFL club in the Championship or League One or whatever it's going to be. And without the Venkies' help, they wouldn't be in the position they are, and they're in a pretty good season. This one is the present season, and fair chance of getting into the playoffs, which could transform the finances again.
Yeah, great result yesterday.
Yeah,
Yeah. Plus, they've got the splendid AJ on Strictly Come Dancing, who could well be in next week's final. She's brilliant. She represents Blackburn very well. I don't know what the financial fair play rules are on Strictly Come Dancing. That's for another pod. Now, occasionally, Kieran, I will get criticised because I will segue from one story into another, say a story about Newcastle and a story about Manchester, by saying still, you know, in that part of the world. And people from both Newcastle and Manchester will go, "We bloody Southerners were totally different." Yeah, so, but I think this next one, Kieran, I think I'm obliged to say, still in the same neck of the woods, because it's a question about Preston, and I don't think even Preston and Blackburn could deny that they are quite close to each other, and the fact, even if they're annoyed that a Cockney has noticed that fact. It comes from Jamie Walmsley, and Jamie says that his club, Preston, have long been criticised by fans for not having a proper youth setup, but with clubs being able to pick off talent for next to nothing, who can blame them? Two youth team scholars, both aged 16, recently signed, or rather, as the club described it, committed to signing professional deals when they turn 17. How does this work? And is there a financial reason for putting this off until they turn 17? And will the contract be similar to a scholarship, but with greater protection for the club financially?
Right. Are you technically a Cockney?
No, I'm not. Well, don't. No, I'm a South Londoner, but don't, because nobody who thinks they're a Cockney is technically a Cockney, because they're talking about the wrong church. Right. It's the Bow Bells Church, which is near Covent Garden, not the church in Bow in the East End. And also, as a mate of mine, loves winding up Cockneys of a certain age, saying, "Well, if you were born during the war, no bells were ringing, so you weren't born within the sound of bow bells anyway." No one's technically a Cockney. And also, while we're on the subject, Cockney rhyming slang's nonsense. This is totally, it's the most easily see-throughable slang you can
Yes, it is.
One criminal in Cockneyland ever used rhyming slang. Imagine being in the pub thinking, right, we better not say stairs in case that bloke's an undercover copper. Let's say apples and pears, because the undercover copper who's from the same part of the world will never see through that. Most, if criminals did use slang in the day, would have used Polari, which is the half Romany, half gay slang that most people in London used. But no, I'm not a proper Cockney, Kieran. I'm a South Londoner, and
so am I. I'm proud of it, just as you are. So.
Of course, yes. Well, see, you're a South East Londoner, Kieran. I'm a South.
Oh right.
Yeah. See, that's where it gets. See, sometimes people outside London don't realise we have the same quibbles that people in Manchester and Liverpool do. So It really bothers a mate of mine when Palace talk about their South London heritage, when they mention South East London, because we're a South London club, not a South East London club. As you'll find out when we play Millwall, who are a South East London club in the FA Cup.
Yes, we've both been invited to that, by the way, by Millwall.
Yeah, Kieran, I've been supporting Palace for many, many years. One of the lessons I've learned is not to accept an invite to a Millwall game from Millwall. Just come down here, mate. It'll be all right. On our shortcuts, fine. Just down this alleyway with no lampposts. Great. Anyway, enough of the East Enders, Danny Dyer small talk. Jamie's question. I'm interested in the answer to this question, Kieran. So I thought, rather than a financial reason for not signing professional deals until they turn 17, that's more of a league regulation reason, isn't it?
It is. You're not allowed to sign your first professional contract until you reach the age of 17. And therefore, you will be on a scholars deal. The scholars deal is an apprenticeship. It's a bit like being an apprentice, electrician or bricky or something like that. So it's not. They don't tend to be particularly well paid. Although some of the wealthier clubs do look after their scholars incredibly well, so the rationale behind this from Preston's perspective in committing to a pre-professional contract agreement is that it gives the club protection. If these two lads are as good as they feel that they are, Preston's concern would be that as a 16-year-old scholar, they could be poached under the EPPP scheme, the Elite Player
Protection.
Which is all geared towards good news for the Premier League, because it allows them to poach players and the club that had developed the player would get a maximum of £40,000 for each year that that young player had been at their at their development club. So by having a pre-agreement, so which effectively commits the player and the club to sign the contract on the 17th birthday, it means that you know, as soon as he turns 17, if he does get poached by another club, that you can then start to demand more money. Well, so that gives the club a bit of protection. Also, from the player's point of view, you know, most scholar contracts, they're only on about $4,000 to $7,000 a year. You know, we're talking relative peanuts. At least he knows that come the age of 17, he's going to be earning a young person's salary, which gives them a bit of commitment going forward. So that's the reason why you can't physically sign a contract at the age of 16. At the age of 17, you can only sign a 3-year contract, and at the age of 18, you can then sign a 5-year contract. There's protection there for the players, because what you don't want to do is player reaches the age of 17, it's still an adolescent.
Yes.
And if the club comes to them and he's a really fantastic player, gets them to sign a 6 or 7 year deal on relative peanuts, then the player's being exploited. So this actually provides a degree of protection for the player.
And also, I hate to be the cynical one in the relationship, Kieran, but if the parents of a player know that their son is committed to signing a professional deal at the age of 17, it might stop them being so easily distracted by another club who, as we know, aren't above offering inducements to parents to lure, as you say, adolescents and children away. There's something wrong about the system somewhere.
The system's absolutely awful. And EPPP was introduced very much as a when the Premier League went to the clubs in the EFL and said that we will give you a guaranteed percentage of the TV monies going forwards, forevermore in effect, but you've got to sign up to EPPP at the same time. It was very much strong arm tactics, and clubs in the EFL didn't really have much of a choice. So it's again, perhaps this is somebody who can see a broader analysis of the way that football operates could address this.
Yeah, quite right. And also, I mean, we say adolescent, but essentially we mean children. They're big children, essentially, and they're big children that have been excited for most of their life about the idea of becoming a professional footballer, who may have not concentrated on education and other issues as much as they should. And it's just, yes, you're right. We'll put that on the list for Tracy.
Yeah.
Mike Clare says, until Kieran recently mentioned parachute payments for clubs relegated to League One, it wasn't something I knew existed. How much are the parachute payments for this? And is it over multiple seasons similar to the League parachute payments?
No. It's just for one season. So clubs relegated from the Championship to League One and clubs relegated from League One to League Two, they get respectively 11% and 12% of what's referred to as the basic award, which is the flat fee that the EFL distributes to its members on an annual basis. And unlike the Premier League, the EFL, and I think this is something which is to be applauded. It doesn't matter whether you finish first or 24th, you get broadly the same amount of money. You'll get a little bit more if you've appeared on telly on more occasions, but it's not geared to if you finish 16th, you get more money than 18th and so on. So as far as the basic award is concerned, in the Championship, that's around about £2.5 million. So 11% of that is £275,000. I think that's right. So you don't. It's not a lot of money in League One, and similarly, it's not a lot of money in League Two. But it just makes a slight difference to allow those clubs who have got players on longer term contracts, just to give them a slightly more of a cushion. And if you get if you get relegated from League Two to the National League, you get 2 years' worth of parachutes from the EFL, the first of which is 100% of your basic award, and the second year it is 50%.
You can't always hear me nodding, Kieran, but I hoped you heard the way I nodded assent when you said 11% of whatever it was 275. And I joined in as though, of course, I knew what that figure was. Why were you even checking it? What I don't know, and this is quite embarrassing because I think we've had a question from this person before, and I think he told me how you pronounce his name, but it was a while ago. It's Stephen Clue. C-L-E-U-G-H. So it could be some kind of cluff. Let's go for Stephen Clue so he can do his own joke about me not having a surname, how to pronounce his surname. But this is a question I really like, and I'm really looking forward to your answer to this. So Stephen's question is simply, would it be more cost-effective to reduce the FA, EFL, EPL to one body and save on the total administrative costs in these trying times? I'd like to see it happen. I'd like to see the meeting where that was put to these people, that they're going to make them one body. But an interesting question, though.
Yes. Remember, the Premier League is a breakaway organisation in exactly the same way that Super League is. And you know, the people who are in favour of Super League said, yeah, look at the Premier League as an example of what can be done. At present, the three organisations have a combined wage bill of just over £90 million a year, which is, you know, that's the wage bill for a bottom six or bottom three or four, perhaps, Premier League club.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is a significant amount of money. It has to be said that the vast majority of those wages are coming from the Football Association itself. The Football Association has over 1,200 employees. Which may surprise people.
That's interesting, Kieran, because instinctively you'd assume the EPL would be the one with the huge wages, but that's
So, but you know, the Football Association is responsible for grassroots football across the whole of the country.
Yeah.
So, therefore, it employs coaches, it employs advisors, it has inspectors, and it's it's. It will also go in and check some of the mechanics of both the clubs at the EFL and the Premier League, which is right and proper to do. So, when the Premier League was set up, it was because what was then the Football League, it was quite fuddy-duddy is perhaps the most appropriate phrase to use. It was sort of very much old school, very much the suits and the procedures of the meetings were very long-winded, and people were arguing about the tiniest of things. So the Premier League was a more nimble organisation when it was set up, and its focus is purely on the marketing of its product, which it does extremely well. So would it save a bit of money if they were combined? It might save some of the wage bill. But ultimately, you've got to look at the money that these three organisations generate. And it could be that the Premier League, because its focus is very much a commercial organisation, its ability to be able to go out and negotiate contracts and broadcasting deals with commercial partners is better than that of the Football Association itself, because its focus is much broader, it's much more social in nature. And you know, ultimately, who do we want in charge of English football? Because some of the people in charge of the FA, they've not covered themselves in glory in recent years. Mm. You know, so yes, you could save some money, but it could also mean that the additional money which is generated by the bodies would actually be lower as well. So it's an interesting one. I'm not sure it would be necessarily that cost effective. Yes, there'll be some duplication. Yes, there is a case for saying that a single body in charge of English football can knock heads together in a way that's not happening at present. You know, the EFL and the Premier League are still at loggerheads with regards to a distribution model. So, one party who can just dictate terms would perhaps have some benefits.
I like your description of the Football League not being very nimble. This is when we were growing up, Kieran, when we first started watching football, the Football League was pretty much running to the same rules as it had done since it started in 1888.
Yes.
And you had these, every time you, or the rare occasions, I should say, because every time implies it was quite often, you know, you'd see there'd always be a fug of cigar smoke or pipe smoke. And even, you know, they used to give a magazine away, remember, in programmes. Every now and again, you'd get the Football League magazine.
Yep.
And there would always be a picture of some executive with a pipe. And, of course, in those days, and a lot of younger people listening to this will be surprised to hear that, if you finished bottom of what is now League Two, you weren't relegated anywhere. You applied for re-election back to the league, and 19 times out of 20, you were re-elected by some arcane procedure. And then if you weren't, they would then decide whether it's a northern team or a southern team that took your place. That was a very strange shenanigan.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, certainly it was an old boys' network.
Absolutely, yes.
And if we still had a single organisation, I think English football would be in a far worse position, because remember the historic view taken by the football authorities that showing football matches live on TV was a bad thing, because it would take people away from attending the matches.
Yeah.
When we know that the opposite, if the football is good, it actually acts as a beacon. If you've got a good product, market it live.
Well, there was actually an embargo when Match of the Day first started up until the late. No, it happened to the mid-80s, basically. They weren't allowed to announce which games were going to be on. So in case it stopped people going to the actual games. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload, and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic, and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Our next question comes from Stuart Hatcher. I do know how to pronounce that name, Kieran, because he's a friend of the show, who I believe took you to lunch before the Brentford game. Is that right?
I believe he's offered to take you for lunch as well when Palace play at Brentford.
Yeah, for Brentford, see Millwall above. Stuart says, with the publication of one of my favourite players, who gave me an autograph at my very first football match, Norwich v Chelsea, Pat Nevin, the accidental footballer, that's the name of the book, it struck me just how lucrative are football biographies, brackets, not football books, as we know, Who Are You and The Price of Football are mega blockbusters. So far, it's been about as lucrative as this pod has. how much would a player/manager expect to make from a book? And any idea who's made the most from theirs? And let's just for shits and giggles throw in, how much would the person who actually wrote the book get?
Yes. Well, as far as books are concerned, My research suggests that the biggest beneficiary of these has been Sir Alex Ferguson. His biography, autobiography, I think around about the time he was retiring, sold around about 800,000 copies, which is phenomenal.
Huge number.
But that is very much the exception. And he would have made around about £1 million is the estimate from that, which is
It's about £1.30 a copy, isn't it? Something like that, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. But as we both know, having written books, I think I get 7% royalty,
right?
On the one that I wrote, and which I then gave away,
of course,
much to the annoyance of the Baroness. I said, well, it only sold 2 dozen copies, so it's a 15 quid for charity. It's not going to make a lot of difference, and it sold a few more than that. Every time I got a letter from an email from the publisher to say, oh, we're gone for our third reprint, fourth reprint, she'd go, how much is this costing me? I said, well, it's not cost. I'm always from the what you've never had, you've never miss school of thought. I said, well, I've never had a royalty check, so technically it's not cost us a penny. But in terms of a high profile player, I think Roy Keane's book, if it's going to be controversial, it'll sell. So Roy Keane's book sold around about 200,000 copies. That's very, very good. Every October you will see footballers' autobiographies coming out, and it helps if you played for Manchester United. Let's be honest, that they are the club with the broadest following in the country. So this Christmas we've got Peter Schmeichel, then we've got Patrice Evra, their books coming out, and they've been. Doing the routine, on the radio and TV shows and
stuff. Yeah, of course.
But they're likely to sell, I think, tens of thousands rather than hundreds of thousands. So, certainly Sir Alex is the most successful. How much of those books have they written themselves? I suspect the ghostwriter will get a pretty small fee from all of that. They will be on a small percentage of the. Of the commission of the player themselves. Mm. Well, it might even be just a fixed amount for putting interviews into words.
In general, the rule of thumb apparently is, because it's still a world that's new to me, that if a book sells in hardback, sells more than 1,000 copies, that's considered hugely successful.
Yeah.
So 800,000 is incredible. I still remember, as you know, I love Jamie Redknapp. I adore him, but I remember having to sit down. I was with him last year when he said, I've got a book coming out. And I got really excited. He went, why are you so excited? I said, sorry, Jamie, I just, when you said I've got a book, that's the bit I got really excited about. So I just thought, my work is done after 10 years. I've finally made him read a book. It's an interesting one as well, because, of course, a lot of you go into WH Smith's, every single, the DVD market has disappeared for comedians, disappeared for comedians. So now they're all writing books.
Yes.
And they're all pretty similar to you read, there's a brilliant podcast based on football biographies from the 70s, and they're pretty much the same template. Very rarely anything of any degree of interest in there, but they're still bizarrely readable. I'm just saying that, Kieran, for karma-wise, because there will be people saying, well, I've bought a book called Who Are You and The Price of Football, and there's barely anything readable in there, to be perfectly honest. Jamie Smith has our next question. And Jamie Smith says, considering some clubs are reluctant to put relegation clauses into their players' contracts, either because it will make it harder to compete in the Premier League or because the owners are rich enough to afford the wages in the lower leagues, would mandatory relegation clauses for all clubs work, and would they be legally enforceable? Would it need to be done by the PL, Premier League, EFL or the FA, or would it need to be acted at FIFA, UEFA level to ensure competitive balance across the countries?
Right. In terms of this, I went for a curry with a chief executive of a Premier League club and asked this very question, which the reply was, we would rather spend the following season in the Premier League than in the Championship. So the players are fully aware of this as well, as our agents. We do have relegation clauses, but it's a lot trickier than it sounds, because especially if you're trying to attract a player from overseas, let's say that, you know, a club's just been promoted, we're now in the January window, and you're trying to sign a player for, you know, 15 million quid, you're offering him, you know, 35, 40 grand a week. If you then have to say, oh, by the way, there's a chance within 6 months that that 30 to 40 grand will have to be reduced by 70 to 80%.
Yeah.
That player's not going to sign for you and you're going to get relegated. So it's a genuine problem to which a simple solution, and lots of people are putting forward simple solutions. And I'm not criticizing Jamie, because I think he's asked a very valid question, to which a simple solution is very challenging indeed. If you take a look at the wage bills of clubs which have been relegated from the Premier League to the EFL, on average, they fall by 40% in the first season. And that sort of ties into, you know, with what's happening in terms of parachute payments. And that will be partly due to redundancies at the club.
Yeah.
If you take a look at the likes of Sunderland and Aston Villa when they drop down out of the Premier League. But if we're honest, you know, back office staff are not paid particularly well. Football is a really poorly paid industry unless you're at the top level.
Yeah.
or you're a player. So there will be some job losses. Some of the players might leave, because if they're good players, they'll be snapped up by Premier League clubs. But for the remaining players, you're probably looking at relegation clauses, 20 to 25%, unless it's a club which has just been promoted, and for the existing squad, they've got automatic step-ups in that first season in the Premier League and automatic step-downs if they then get relegated after one season. So it's genuinely tricky. They do exist at present, but, you know, if I was the owner of Stoke City, you know, who gets paid £400 million a year from Bet365, to say, well, yeah, I can afford to maintain that level of wage.
Yeah.
Why should we be forced as an employer to give our employees a pay cut when we're quite happy to pay their wages? You know, unhappy staff equals demotivated staff equals staff who are less productive. So it's not as simple as I think. As some of the people who say automatic clauses work, and I know this is an issue which is included in the fan-led review. Perhaps it's something else again we can talk to with Tracy. As far as who would enact this, it would have to be a joint agreement between Premier League and EFL and the PFA, because you
yes,
may recall at the start of last season, the EFL in Leagues 1 and 2 had automatic wage caps introduced, £2.5 million in League 1 and £1.5 million in League 2. And the PFA took them to a tribunal, and the PFA won, partly due to the fact that they had Nick DiMarco as their representative. And, you know, as we know, Nick's a pretty smart cookie when it comes to these things. So it would have to be agreed by the PFA. As far as getting FIFA or UEFA level approval, that wouldn't be the case, because there are some countries, such as the MLS in the USA, in which there are automatic wage caps anyway. But of course, there's no relegation to worry about there.
It's because the reaction of some Premier League chief execs to some parts of the fan-led review, you know, as we've discussed, phrases like Maoist, phrases like government interference, I can't imagine they'd be particularly happy about the idea of mandatory relegation clauses. But again, as you say, we'll mention that when we talk to Tracy in the next pod. Now, Edward Murphy has a very interesting question, I think. Edward says, we saw how the Glazers and other groups have managed to buy football clubs with very little capital of their own. Why don't we see more fan groups using this as a vehicle to take ownership of their club?
Right. I mean, you're absolutely right. The Glazers put next to nothing in to the acquisition of Manchester United, but they did borrow £700 million as well. So we've also got the situation where we are seeing clubs being sold for a pound, and we've covered this topic as well.
Yep.
Before. when you take over a football club, you're effectively buying the shares of that football club, and therefore you acquire both its assets and its liabilities. So you might buy a football club for £1, but if it's got debts of £20 million, then that's effectively added on to your costs, because at some point in time you're going to have to pay off those costs.
Yeah.
The problem with buying a football club, regardless of the price, is it's not necessarily how much you pay for it, is that you've then got a business to run where 80% of your competitors and potentially you are loss-making. So why can fans not take ownership of clubs as easily as perhaps they might like to? Is that at the end of the month, you've got the wages to pay, and you have a meeting of the committee formed by the fans to say, well, okay, you know, we're short of 100 grand this month. Where's that going to come from?
Yeah.
Because the fans have all of good intentions, but good intentions don't pay the bills.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge for fan-owned clubs, and that's why we've seen some fan-owned clubs, such as Portsmouth, such as Wickham, and Wickham managed to get into into the Championship, and they actually published their accounts a few days ago. And they did extremely well in the Championship. They made a profit despite a year in which COVID was operating. They made a profit of over £3 million. And I know, I know that they listen to the show. So perhaps we'll send them out an invite to have a chat, because it's an interesting ownership. It's the Kohig family. They're also doing extremely well in League One this season, so it can be done that you can operate in the Championship and make money. As soon as I put those numbers out, though, fans of other clubs say they've got relegated, though. And the previous season, the only club to have made a profit in the Championship was Rotherham, who got relegated. So you know, there is this price to pay.
Well done, Finlay. I suspect there are people listening to this pod simply for Finlay's input.
Yes.
And they've had to wait quite so. Have you put him outside? He sounds like he's long distance.
No, he's. We got a new box of Wonky Chomps delivered on Friday, and he's in the kitchen with the Baroness, sort of giving it the full puppy dog eyes. I'm starving to death. So he's only barking because somebody's just come to deliver.
Yeah,
well, to next door.
As we know, it's a technique that works for you. So I'm sure that's where Finlay learned it from, to be perfectly honest. Our penultimate question comes from Bradley Glover. And it's not strictly a finance question. It could be, but I think it's well worth asking anyway, because it's an interesting question. All our questions are interesting. I don't mean to imply that some are more so than others, but this is an interesting one. And Bradley Glover says his question is about referees. Based on the top quality European referees we saw during the Euros, if Premier League teams can import in the best players from all over the world, what is stopping the Premier League importing the best referees, as difficult as that may be to judge from abroad? And we do have there's a couple of Australian referees working in VAR permanently, I understand. And there was a time back during the 80s and 90s and even later when a couple of the Old Firm games in Glasgow, they got in an English referee to save any complaints about bias. So it's not unprecedented, is it, Kieran? So could it be done financially?
It certainly could be done, though I think that PGMOL, who are the Professional Game
Match Officials Limited,
they might have some objections, because they will say, well, you know, our members have had to come through the system and as somebody that you was a qualified referee myself and got to know a little bit about the system many years ago, that it's tough making your way up the ladder. And if people who go into refereeing, especially if they go into refereeing young, think that, well, you know, now just like the ultimate dream of a young football player is to reach the professional level. When they start off as youth team players, the same is true for referees, that could act as a disincentive. It could be argued that PGMOL is a bit of a closed shop as well, and they don't want people coming into it. So, you know, it's effectively the union. The other issue would be the reaction of the Home Office, because you have to have a governing body endorsement to recruit football players from overseas, and it could be that PGMOL decide that they're going to object to, you know, overseas referees coming on, stealing, you know, taking our jobs on a similar basis. So you'd have to have either the Premier League or the Football Association backing up these recruitments. So yeah, it's not impossible. My view is that I think referees get a pretty hard time.
Yeah.
You know, I just say to somebody, just try it. Just try it for 1 year, and then come back and tell us how easy it is. And that's in park football. You multiply the speed of the players by 50% in the professional game, and you'll see that it's you know, referees make mistakes, players cheat. That, you know, there's a big difference between the two.
Can you imagine the Daily Mail response if a French referee got a decision wrong in a Liverpool Man U game? That would just be the ultimate orgasmic story for the Daily Mail, wouldn't it? Kieran, how did it work with you as a referee of your colour blindness? Did you have different shape cards for yellow and red?
Well, I can tell yellow and red, but I think I had one was oval and the other one was rectangular.
Oh, okay. Right.
And the reason why you do that is that it's not a colour issue, it's a feel issue, because when you put your hand into your pocket to pull out a card, what you want to make sure is that you pull out the right one. So therefore, you know, I'd actually tell by touch to make sure that I'm pulling out the right card. because the last thing you want to do is, you know, if you pull out a yellow instead of a red, you then got to go, oh Christ, now I do have to go and downgrade this, because that was an absolute, yeah, that was a life threatening tackle.
Yeah,
so that was the way. Colour blindness was actually an issue for me, because I did get judged. You know, you get inspected, and I did have problems, but you know, I was reluctant to admit to it.
Of course. I think just as a general life lesson, Kieran, it's always nice to put your hand in the pocket and pull out the right one, isn't it? you can't leave that hanging in the universe.
True.
Our last question comes from John Brosnan, and John has obviously clocked that the best way to get a question answered on this show is to make it about football kits, and the second best way is to add in a really bizarre addendum, which he's done, which is, there's no way this question wasn't getting asked. And John Brosnan's question is this: who decides which font is used on the back of players' shirts, as in the player's name and the style of shirt number? Do the kit manufacturers have to pay another company for the use of particular fonts? And if so, how much? Or if Adidas, for example, supply your kit, but do you have no option but to take the style of numbers and lettering they supply you with? Finally, and I know this will sound nuts, but can a team play with shirts that are labelled with, numbered with Roman numerals? Imagine Messi in the next year. And of course, back in the early days of shirt numbering, they did also experiment with having A, B, C, D, E on the back of one team and numbers on the back of the other, and having 1 to 11 for one team and 12 to 22 for the other. So, again, like many things in football, these things that we take for granted weren't immediately settled when they were introduced. But it's a good question. Bizarre. I mean, Arsenal's bizarre Gothic numeral just looks really odd. So again, are they paying a separate company for the font?
I don't think you have to pay for a font as such, but it does say, if we go to rule M9 of the Premier League handbook, it says the size, style, colour and design of shirt numbers, lettering and the logo of the league appearing on a player's shirt or shorts and the material from which they must be made shall be determined by the Premier League board from time to time.
Oh, okay.
So it is definitive. I think the Arsenal one was that restricted to non Premier League games. Was their European version?
Oh, was it? Okay, I didn't realise.
I know that because there was, until relatively recently, I think one of the rugby union clubs played in letters as opposed to numbers.
Ah, yes, I believe you're right.
But in terms of letters, it says here the number of the shirts, it has to be a number and starts with one and increases by one per player.
So it is definitely a number rather than a letter. So that is, again, part of Section M of the club operations part of the Premier League handbook, available to download as a PDF, 339 pages of absolute nerdiness. if you've got a partner and you've got a printer, just go and print the whole thing off and say it's from Santa and give it to the nerd in your life. They'll keep them quiet for a few days over Christmas.
Well, if anything, Kieran, what we've guaranteed here is that football games this week, some people in pubs are going to be confused when their mate comes up to them and says, "Did you know you can't have Roman numerals on the back of a football shirt?" And they're going to go, "You've been listening to that Price of Football podcast again, haven't you?" You go, yeah. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod that tells you you can't have Roman numerals on the back of your football shirt, then that would be lovely. And please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. But, of course, our pod itself will always be free to air. If you have a question you like answered on the show, especially about kits, then email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, thanks again, folks, for the feedback. If you just want to give us some good karma in relation to the show, if you can go to that icon on your app for Apple and give us a review, if you'd like to give us 5 stars, that really does help. If you want to write a few words, that doesn't make a blind bit of difference, according to producer Guy. You can write whatever you want. You could say that it was. You'd rather it presented by Virginia Wade and John Richardson, and it wouldn't make a blind bit of difference, apparently, to us in the ratings.
I would definitely. That's the one I'm most likely to listen to. John would be terrified. Thank you for listening, everybody.
And rightly so.
Yes, indeed. I've met them both. They're both absolutely lovely people. John's an old mate. I love John dearly, but Virginia Wade is very charming. She's very lovely, and very historically important to the sport of tennis. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. The Price of Football.